This week, the impressive precious metals rally continued for the fifth week running. Silver flew higher by $2, closing just shy of 20 an ounce. Welcome back, everyone. Chris Waltzek, it's just great to be back with you this weekend. Another exciting week for precious metals investors. Gold shares have nearly doubled now from the yearly low, and silver's up 50% from its low, adding 11% this week alone. In this information-packed installment, James Machuga, Senior Vice President of Merck Investments, makes his show debut. He suggests that every investor adds at least 20% gold in their portfolios. He outlines their 100% gold-backed ETF. Next up, Bob Hoy, Senior Investment Strategist, returns to the show. We discuss Dr. Greenspan's call for a gold standard, which now looks a bit prescient considering what's happened in the past few weeks. The former Fed chair says he's a gold bug. A gold standard was the key to early success in the United States economy. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals sector for the fifth week running on a weak U.S. dollar amid lowered rate hike expectations. By Friday's closing bell on the yellow metal, gold was up $20 for the week, 1.5%, ending at $13.39 an ounce. But the showstopper, once again, silver. Its best point in nearly 2 years, up over $2.03, almost 11.5%, while the precious metals XAU shares added almost 10%, finishing at 102.5. Precious metal shares are approaching a 200% gain from trough to peak this year. West Texas Intermediate crude rebounded from 129 a barrel, closing just above 49.28 a barrel. That's up $1.7 for the week, 3.6%. Meanwhile, the top story driving the precious metals market this week stemmed from last week's Brexit event. News that the UK would leave the EU led to considerable portfolio adjustments this week, primarily by institutions and pension funds, which had to adjust their proprietary models to accommodate new forecasts. Gold and silver recorded the best six-month rally in decades on the heels of the newly dovish Fed. According to the current Fed funds contracts, odds favor no additional rate hikes this year. Investors were betting that rates would increase at least one time. Nevertheless, the Brexit outcome convinced policymakers that economic uncertainty in the EU could ignite a global economic slowdown. The news sent investors back into the safe haven assets, as seen in record gold ETF purchases. Statements from the ECB and the BOE suggest that both central banks are preparing for further QE operations to support their regional economies. In related news, Goldman Sachs raised its gold target for the year by $100 to $1,300, according to a report received on Monday. Morgan Stanley also increased its forecast, citing risks from Brexit and potential for inflation. Adding to the bullish case for gold, the gold-to-silver ratio, or the number of silver ounces required to purchase a single ounce of gold, dropped below 72. That's the best figure in a year. Plus, investors continue to pile into the exchange-traded funds backed by gold, adding $12 billion to the Gold Spider ETF so far this year, according to a Bloomberg report. Precious metals, bottom line. Clearly, the Brexit stunned central bankers. Now the Fed governors don't want to rock the boat, I think, until after the November election. The dollar is technically overbought here, which could also open a window of opportunity for this stealth rally to continue. Next week, the U.S. markets will be closed on Monday in observance of U.S. independence. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, sunny skies returned over the New York Stock Exchange on lowered rate hike expectations. The Dow Jones Industrials added 548 points, over 3%, finishing just shy of 18,000 for the week, recouping most of its recent losses. The S&P 500 picked up 65, over 3%, ending at 2103, while the NASDAQ added 154, also over 3%, climbing back above 4862. Meanwhile, U.S. equities posted the best four-day rally in nearly a year as investors around the globe directed funds into U.S. equities. Many of our favorite leading economic indicators continue to show solid economic conditions, including U.S. new housing starts, which made new highs and lows since the end of the Great Recession. As one of the most important sectors in the economy, strong home building tends to create new jobs, employment opportunities in construction, landscaping, and the numerous supporting activities. That means more money in pockets and wallet books, which means increased spending and, of course, improved corporate profits. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, volatility, as viewed by the CBOT VIX, finally returned to the mean, while the fear to greed index is showing signs of greed. I think the combined effect suggests that this week might just be looked back on as a short covering squeeze, and I still continue to expect better buying opportunities later in the year. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. James Machuga, Senior Vice President of Advisory Services at Merck Investments, with 7 years of financial service experience, at least with the company. Welcome to the show on your debut appearance here.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me, Chris.
You know, I thought we could start off today with maybe a bit of levity. On Monday, former Fed head Alan Greenspan, you may have read that, well, maybe some of his theories just didn't work out as well as they did theoretically. We need to return to a gold standard. And that would seem to imply a lack of faith or loss of faith in the reserve currency. I thought the Federal Reserve was in charge of the U.S. dollar.
Yeah, you know, and that's interesting. We get a lot of feedback that talks about whether or not going back to the gold standard would be an improvement or even feasible at this point. In our opinion, we see not only in the U.S., but globally, just continuing to get further and further away from the gold standard. We see central banks being more involved in rate decisions, which they historically have been, but also new quantitative easing methods that vary depending on which central bank is being more active. And at Merck, we talk about the fact that, you know, a gold standard may be something that you would like to implement for yourself, something to think about for your own portfolio, as, you know, the governments and the central bankers aren't really providing that type of backing for a physical gold component to back your currency anymore. So we really encourage people to take it actively into their own investment, in their own hands.
Well, I think it's sage advice, especially considering the Brexit. The pound sterling took quite a pummeling, if you will, following the news, which apparently surprised a lot of investors and led to readjustments within institutional portfolios. The reserve currency of choice when fiat money fails tends to be the precious metals. Most, I think, mainstream economists wouldn't expect or would not have taught their students in classroom scenarios to expect in their lifetimes major shifts, if you will, in primary themes in the underlying currencies. And I know that currency is, of course, a major focus of Merck Investments. Perhaps you might give us some more feedback regarding the volatility in the market.
Yeah, and you know what? Maybe I can start by saying, like you said, to conventional wisdom, I don't think any professors or anybody who's historically looked at the markets can really compare this time that we're experiencing to anything that's occurred in the past. The big combatant to gold, it seems, is any interest-bearing instrument. You know, people say, why own gold if it doesn't bear any interest? You could own cash. You can hold any other instrument that yields. Well, when you're in a period where central banks globally are at lower negative interest rates, the amount of outstanding debt that's out there isn't really feasible to be financed at higher interest rates, and you're expecting to have lower negative interest rates for a sustained period of time, well, that brick of gold starts to look a lot more attractive because nothing is paying you anything to hold cash, and in some cases, it's negative yield. So I think that the medium to longer term view for gold has really improved. In regards to the Brexit, I thought it was interesting right after the vote came in that Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, said that he would intervene and to support the financial markets, which was followed by Mario Draghi, who also reiterated his whatever it takes policy as financials were hit around Europe. And I think that this is something we're going to continue to see. And it leaked even over into the U.S., where we were talking about when the next interest rate hike is going to be. Now they're talking about potentially an interest rate cut leading into the end of the year and pushing off interest rate hikes until 2017. So what the Brexit brought back to the market was people looked to gold as a safe haven after the event, and you saw pop. So the extended case for gold really enforced by central bank policy came out right after. Now, in terms of currencies, one of the things that we like to look at, because we saw some of the polling prior to the Brexit vote, what we like to do is look at implied volatility in the options market for currencies, because when you have people that are levering up or buying increased insurance in the options market on a specific currency, it indicates to us volatility. And volatility in currencies is typically a negative. So in terms of the pound, we saw a sharp sell-off. I think you really need to see where management, quote-unquote, is going to take this Brexit over the next 3-5 years and have a game plan together before you can have some rebuilding in the value of the currency or see a bottoming of that currency for a turnaround.
So moving on to the next topic, more specifically, opportunities within the precious metals sector. Merck Investments, quite interested in the potential for profits there. It's been a very challenging 5 years. Would you care to give us some underlying fundamental reasons for perhaps increasing exposure to the yellow metal?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the key things that we look at in terms of gold is from a portfolio construction standpoint. You look back to 1970s and going up until today, and you've got a correlation in gold to equities that's either zero or very close to zero. So for people that have concerns about market volatility, about their overall portfolios, we think that adding in a lowly correlated asset class like gold can create a lot of value. And on top of that, you have an average annual return going back to the 70s of about 8% or so. And that starts to look attractive to many investors. Gold, over the past few years, has struggled. We saw a sell-off after the peak. And also in, I believe it was April of, 2014? It's hard to put the years together. But basically, we saw the same thing that can happen in any market. You know, you had a lot of momentum players that got into gold, people that had chased returns. They had levered up their trades. And when they started to unwind them, the fall in gold was very drastic, and it scared a lot of people from coming back into the gold market for years. We don't think that that's indicative of just the gold market, but of any market. You know, you look right now in the equity markets over the past 6 years or so, risk premia has been compressed to very, very low levels, where you see a VIX in the low teens for sustained periods of time, and investors going into equities that feel like it's more of a safer investment than historically it has been. And when volatility picks back up, just like it had in gold, you can see a vast unwinding of that in a rapid sense, and you know, it can scare investors. So we think that, you know, what we saw in gold a few years ago in terms of drop of price could very well happen in equities or in bonds. And gold has become more attractive because as equities has gone up over the last 6 years, as bonds has been in this super bull market for the past 20 years, gold looks relatively at a value. You know, it hadn't appreciated up with equities. It hadn't appreciated up with bonds in tandem as things have become more correlated. And now you're starting to see gold become a lot more attractive and the price to rise. So we think that from a portfolio construction standpoint, it makes sense because of its low correlation. From a value standpoint, we see a lot more people looking for things that aren't overbought, and gold comes into that realm right now.
And then let's also address the precious metal shares. You know, we've seen roughly a, let's say, 100% move from trough to peak here over the past several months in 2016. That, of course, a very large on a percentage basis, but the shares are known for volatility. Do you all like the concept of adding precious metals shares to the portfolio mix?
We've done some back testing to look at what the optimal mix is between gold and equities and gold and equities and bonds. And what it amounts to is typically a higher amount than most investors would hold in the 20% range or so to get optimal risk-adjusted returns. What we like to share with people is, you know, gold is a volatile asset class. It's got a deviation in the 20s, which is similar to equities over time. Never own more than you feel comfortable with. You don't want to go to bed owning more gold than you feel comfortable with. So it really does vary, but we do think it's a valuable component for people to have in their portfolio, whether it be for a small amount because of the volatility that they don't want to add into their portfolio, or a larger amount. But when you are counteracting that with other investments and you're diversified, it can create a smoother ride over time. It's a question that you have to address with yourself, with your financial advisor, and come up with the right plan for you.
Crude oil had suffered along with the commodities CRB index for several years and rebounded as well this year. We've seen quite a move from under 30 to around the $50 area and then consolidation. Do you see further upside for crude, or will the economic uncertainty developing in the EU derail the advance in the energy sector?
That's a great question, Chris. Merck, we focus on monetary policy, currencies, and gold. Granted, the macro trends like the price of oil do impact some of our decisions and some of the countries that are very impacted, like Norway and Canada and those countries that are tied closely to energy and oil. But in terms of the forecast for oil, I don't know if I can help you out too much there, other than the fact that I think the correlation between oil and equities elevated. I think that when you see global tensions, you've seen oil fall back a little bit, as well as periods of lower volatility, oil's been able to advance. The only thing that I can, kind of point people to consider is, you'll monitor how it's trending relative to other things that you might invest in, because you don't want to get caught with too much. I think that a topic that we've been discussing, and one that's been more prevalent in the gold space, is knowing how you own gold. There's different forms that you can. You can own them in miners. You can own them in bullion. You can lease gold. You can borrow against gold, whatever it may be. In our focus at Merck, within our gold product, we try to keep it as pure as possible, 100% backed by gold bullion, and give investors the chance to take delivery at any time. One of the charts that I see circulating is the amount of gold ounces in existence versus claims on gold. And for every ounce that's out there, there's 500 plus claims on that 1 ounce of gold. So I just encourage investors to know what you own, to dive in deep, and make sure that if you want to invest in gold bullion, the vehicle that you're using is in fact backed by gold bullion. We're going to enter into a period of time where paper-backed gold, it just has a different dynamic. So I would just encourage your investors and your listeners to do their research and make sure that they know what they own in the gold space, and to reach out to us if you want to have any of those conversations as well.
When the chips are down, any paper contract, there's always an extra question mark at the end there as far as safety, valuation, return of investment. Nothing tops that physical component. James Machuga, perhaps you could tell us a bit more about Merck Investments and some of the interesting services you provide.
Sure. Merck Investments is a mutual fund and ETF company based out of San Francisco. We have two 40 Act mutual funds that are focused on the currency asset class. One that is a U.S. dollar bear type of fund. It gives your investors diversification outside of the U.S. dollar. And the other is a tactical long short actively managed currency strategy, which we seek to profit from currency moves on a daily basis. And then our third product is the VanEck Merck Gold ETF. The ticker on that is OUNZ, as an ounce. We launched this product a couple of years ago. The reason that we brought it to market is we wanted to have a product that was very pure and very transparent in the gold space. So we launched Ounce, which is 100% backed by physical gold on a daily basis, and it offers investors the option to take physical delivery of gold at any time, which is not a taxable event by taking physical delivery of gold. You can get gold in 1 ounce coins or 10 ounce bars or all the way up to the London bars. So we thought this was a very unique product to bring to market, and we've had fantastic growth and adoption in the marketplace, and we hope to continue having success there.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Chris, for having me on today.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Mr. Bob Hoy, Editor-Chief Investment Strategist of InstitutionalAdvisors.com. That's all one word. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Very good, then, Chris.
Someone else is back with us this week, and that, of course, would be the former Fed head, Mr. Alan Greenspan, or Sir Greenspan, as he's known in certain circles. Kind of interesting comments we were discussing before the show. Shocking comments, you might even call them. With all due respect to to Dr. Greenspan, he has now reached the remarkable age of 90 years, that if we return to a gold standard similar back to prior 1913, and we all know what happened then, we would save the United States.
When he was a younger man in the 60s, hung out with Ayn Rand and that group. And he did publish, I think it was 1966, a piece pointing out that the best, it wasn't perfect, but the best thing for a central bank reserve to have gold as a reserve, and then that would be used as a backing for the currency. And then you have a limit on what a central bank can do by the way of credit stimulation. So it was a well-argued piece. It's been a long time since I've read it. And then there were various times during his tenure as head of the Fed that I would think, okay, now, he said one thing I recall was it was something on free trade that showed his colors as a conservative. And then you also had that he was the public man, and the public man has to say certain things, particularly when you're chairman of the Fed. So there was that. But also, I think he might have published it occasionally, but that he was, when he was head of the Fed, he was running the Federal Reserve System as if he was the perfect Keynesian. And let her rip, guys. And I would, every once in a while, and particularly the time he came out and said something in support to free trade, I thought the guy underneath it is still a Randian or a conservative, you know. Maybe underneath it all, he wants to blow up the Fed and to demonstrate that it really doesn't work. Those were idle thoughts. They are still idle thoughts today. But in that he has reintroduced the idea of a gold standard, it's worth pursuing. And myself and history would agree that the central bank should go back onto a gold standard. Now, we should look at the argument that the intruders have used, is that they feel that they need to manage the economy. And they do this by liberal discounting from time to time. And the thing is that they never, ever did not discount. I swear the Fed has been easy since it opened the doors in 14. If you put in a gold standard, then that limits the ambition of central bankers. The reason for not having gold is so that the central bankers can, quote, manage the economy. And we've shown that they have no discipline whatsoever. They have no forecasting method. They have no common sense. And they have done the worst depreciation of currencies since the 1500s. And prior to that, the worst one was with the Roman Empire as it became a police state. So it's been very profound what they have done. So what Greenspan is saying that you need a discipline. And the discipline is, of course, has always been gold. You've had with the European experiment the notion that with they were going to be budgets were going to be 3% of something or other, and you had the discipline of the European Central Bank. But actually, there has never been any discipline imposed. The view I've had is that when the big reformation comes, the public would move to take over, you know, move to run the government rather than have experts run the government. And, of course, this is what the big step is with the EU and the British Brexit vote. And the other one would be that the public would demand to call money what it is, and that once it figures it out, the public has a lot of common sense. And the Brexit vote, I take as a vote for common sense. You take a look at England, spent huge amounts of treasure and blood in World War One and World War Two, which was to protect itself from an experiment, two experiments in Europe of authoritarian government. And what you have now in the last while is that an experiment in authoritarian government is taking over England. And the issue, people might have talked about immigration, but the issue truly is the sovereignty of British Parliament. And this is where the folks grabbed some common sense and said, we're going to take her out of here. So, of course, you know, the last time European forces moved to introduce authoritarianism to England was when William in 1066 invaded Europe and brought in feudalism. Prior to that, Europe wasn't feudal, and feudal was control like you wouldn't believe. So this is politically very refreshing, and in that it is encouraged at least one thinker of it, and sure, Greenspan's 90, but there's nothing senile about saying proper backing for a currency is a gold reserve. And at some point, more and more people will realize that, but mainly it'll be the public that'll say, hey, your experiment with all of these stimulative ideas and easing and quantitative easing hasn't worked, and it's put all of our money as taxpayers on the line. I think this is the European vote, or the British vote, is a huge step towards what we could call eventually a great reformation, and that then within this, the next step would be the public imposing its view upon the experts of what money is and should be. And, of course, we all know that is money is a unit of account, it's a unit of trade, and it should be have some intrinsic value to it so that people will hold on to it. But you've had now, I guess, more than 100 years of central bankers instructing that with a constantly depreciating currency, the only thing you can do is speculate. On the long side, we've seen what that's doing here. So I would welcome Greenspan's introduction of a discussion on a gold standard. And I think that there's going to be the current set of economists at the Federal Reserve. And I might say that there are no bankers at the Federal Reserve. They're all PhDs in economics, and some wags have called it the PhD standard, which is ridiculous. Because, you know, you go back to when they opened the doors in 2014 or 1914, and I think the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar has declined to about 3.5% or 3.5 cents from a dollar then. So that continuous experiment hasn't been needed at all. The other thing that I was thinking about the other day, Chris, was that even Friedman was wrong on his suggestion that money supply should grow at a constant 3% a year. You don't need anybody at a central bank or government level suggesting that there's a certain growth rate of money. It's not needed because in a speculative world, and every 4 or 5 year business cycle ends up with a little bout of speculation, and sometimes they end up with a huge bout of speculation. But the private sector can create all the credit it needs, and then more so by leverage. Whether you're speculating in real estate or the stock markets, and New York Stock Exchange margin figures are available. And I could say that throughout all of financial history, at least the last 400 years, that in every speculative boom, highly energized speculators have been able to get hold of all the credit they want. And then the problem is when the prices go down, that's a bad thing, and you end up with a huge amount of debt left. So the basic theories of economic intervention have been very naive, and essentially from perhaps bright individuals with no experience who think that financial markets need meddling with. So just to wrap this up, Chris, I would say that I really welcome Greenspan's suggestion about looking at a gold standard, because looking at all of history, it is the best of all worlds. You can't think of a better one, otherwise you get into utopian stuff. But even then, being on a gold standard doesn't limit private speculation, but it does limit the ability of governments to become speculative.
It's precisely the focus of his comments in that discussion, in that he implies, I think it's implied, or at least I inferred, all of the blame squarely on the fiscal side. I find that interesting. Nothing whatsoever against the monetary side, which, of course, his argument was it's social policies, which we all know, a.k.a. we're talking about Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, disability. So I find that interesting that he lays all the blame on the legislative side, if you will, or the fiscal side, and he ignores the monetary component here.
I've been writing papers on the Great Reformation for...
Yeah, but don't you hope that it will be more of a renaissance than a reformation? Because we all know what followed years of brutal, sanguinary battle.
That was Europe. But what one wants to do is look at England, because the 1500s and into this early 1600s, bureaucrats in search of power corrupted the Christian church. They will corrupt anything when the power gets going. So the calling it the Protestant Reformation was just the religious side. What indeed happened is that society looked at the institutions, the authoritarian institutions that developed, and either ended them or sidetracked them or whatever. And it was, and particularly, again, I say in England, you had in Germany, particularly at the 30 Years' War, very nasty stuff, ostensibly between Protestants and Catholics, but it was really a struggle between authoritarians and those who liked freedom. Now, that struggle took place in England, and it was satisfied and resolved with much less bloodshed. Sure, you had the British Civil War in the 1640s, but if you want to take a look at something really wonderful, the Glorious Revolution of 1688, where business, Protestant interest in London and everywhere else in England of varying economic stature, took a look at an authoritarian king who was trying to impose his authority and was talking about bringing French Catholic troops over to back him up. And the business interests in London led it and brought in William of Orange. And it was effectively a bloodless revolution. So this is what I think is happening now, another glorious revolution.
You know, Dr. Greenspan, who reportedly earned $10 to $12 million on his book contract, probably has accumulated a substantial amount of the yellow metal, wouldn't you say?
I hope so. Is you have two people there. You've got the original young man who understood gold, and you have the public figure. And the public figure has to say certain things. So this is where I think you have the contrast, and I accept it. I don't see it as any sort of thing as a change or a religious conversion or anything like that. It's Greenspan of 1966, and in between he was the head central banker for a while, and he had to do what the head central banker had to do. And plus, as I suggested, maybe at times he might have thought, well, why not apply the full Keynesian remedies, recipes, and blow the whole thing up? And then, of course, later on you had Bernanke come along who, while a scholar, was clueless, and he did much to blow it up. So you've created a tremendous dissatisfaction amongst the public at a time when they are beginning to question things. And this has happened before many times, going way back to Roman times, where the general public, even earlier than Roman times, back into ancient Egypt, where the general public looks at the governing classes and looks at the promises from the governing classes, looks at their own dissatisfaction and says, you're out of here. And it has happened with dynastic changes in ancient Egypt. It's happened at the end of the 300s in Rome and the early 1600s in Europe. And this is another, the start of another huge, great reformation. And I'm really excited about it.
I found it also interesting that he pointed out that he is a, quote, gold bug. He says everyone laughs at him because of that. And he asks, why do you think central banks own gold, if it's so funny? But what I wanted to bring up to you against that backdrop, this period he refers to as from 1870 to 1913, he refers to as one of the most aggressive economic periods in U.S. history. He underscores the point there was no Fed and there was a gold standard. And he's using that, say, a pillar of support for his thesis. Do you think this period, 1870 to 1913, was an anomaly? Or can America return to that type of economic growth if we were to return to a gold standard?
Oh, no, it was just another. 1873 was a bubble year. And then you went into a 20-year Great Depression. 1884, economists in England were looking at the long contraction and saying, oh, they called it the Great Depression. And that went on until the final recession completed in 1895. And then that contraction completed. But within this, England contracted, prices fell, land values fell. But in the United States, U.S. was doing what China's been doing over the last 20 years, this great revival. And they went from 5% of global industrial production to about 20%. They might have even outdid China, but at any rate, if you looked at the senior economy, it was a classic bubble in 1873 and a classic 20-year Great Depression, and of which in each of these depressions you have terrific, because of the pricing pressures, you have terrific improvements in productivity. And I believe the same thing's going on here, but 2007 had all of the earmarks of a classic bubble, and then that was confirmed by you had the worst recession since the 1930s, and the rebound out of 2009 is just the first business expansion out of a classic crash, and now it's all starting to roll over. The stock market has clocked a key rebound for this year to certain moving averages we've been using, and as of the last weeks, failed. And this is the one I was just writing now, is that the key thing here is the technical accomplishment on the rebound this year and the technical failure. Brexit was just a catalyst, and that then prompted Greenspan to come up with this. So I welcome any conversations about a gold standard. It is the best way to discipline those who are ambitious in government.
You sort of alluded to this very early on in the discussion today, where you talked about, well, it's a reformation, I think preferably a renaissance, and we are going to return, you know, the monetary system to the people. But one of the concerns that even the founders of America had, we need to be cautious that the masses never really have the ability to completely control the monetary system, because we've seen how that unfolded in revolutionary France that you talked about. It was really 100 years of revolution, if you want to know, that culminated with Napoleon Bonaparte. I think there is some concern that once, you know, in the last days of Rome, once the people realized they could vote in or they could control who had the reins of the money supply, it wasn't long before the currency was worthless.
They knew that, and they then put in silver. But history has shown that there's no better money than gold. There's nothing better. And any experiment in alternatives runs to a disaster. So in the Western world, for the last 100 years, it has been run by neurotic intellectuals. And the movement now is the public taking over things and getting away from neurotic intellectuals. By neurotic intellectual, I mean, you know, some guy, and they think that they can run the world.
Help us with the social issue, and it's a touchy one. Power tends to accumulate in certain groups, certain
cliques.
Thank you. I like that term better. And then, of course, what we find is that the masses oftentimes are really the last ones holding the hot potato. Really, the music has already stopped. I think you'd agree. And now it's just a bunch of jockeying and positioning that's going on. And, of course, there's some, what do they call it, damage control?
Oh, no, it's going to be a nasty contraction. But this was the thing, and the experiment in Rome, the state, price and wage controls, backed up by the sword, it just ran out of steam. 310 AD, the state lost control. It lost the ability to depreciate the currency. And Rome collapsed very quickly. And then the state moved over to Constantinople because there was money there, but there was no money in Rome. So, no, this is... And then the same thing in the early 1600s. The public... And England, trust me on this one, is the best to look at for the history. The public just said, enough. They had to have a king. They had to have a church. And they worked their way out, and they had a very successful revolution. So I call this as a popular uprising based upon a broad dissatisfaction. And at the moment within the United States, that movement is gaining power. And it is going to change things. And then in England, it suddenly appeared as the vote on this Brexit. And it's part of the same movement, because these previous examples ran for about 100 years. And by that time, the bureaucrats spent all the money, blew all the wealth, and the public figured it out. So let's put it this way. The bureaucrats this time have had 100 years of spending everybody's money, and the public is now just starting to figure it out.
When the powers that be relinquish control like that, what makes me concerned here is that this is a trap of some sort. So let's just play out a possible scenario that I have not heard anyone even examine. You know, it was a close vote. The powers that be are allowing it to happen. I find interesting.
Chris, they're not allowing it to happen.
And there is considerable voting machine fraud. It's accepted. It's expected now today because it's so easy to hack these machines online. Statistically, the outcomes are impossible. 10 sigma style events where the, you know, the likelihood is just a trillion to one or more. What if the powers that be allowed, and I say allowed, not intervened fully? What if they know something that we haven't thought all the way through? For instance, distance, surprising concerns at the Ukrainian border, lots of strife and tension between Ukraine, you know, an oil hotbed, and Russia, the Crimean. We also have the Middle East issue. The EU decided to side more towards that side of this hemisphere. It would suddenly put the UK at a remarkable disadvantage in the next war.
This is now out of their hands. It's just as much as the Soviet Politburo allowed the Berlin Wall to be taken down. Oh, it's the same thing. The authoritarianism requires 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of hammering the fist down. On the other side of that is the people who are submissive, and that requires 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of being submissive. And then there's an instant. In 1957 in Hungary, they sent in the tanks. In 1968 in Prague, they sent in the tanks. In 1989, they did not send in the tanks. They lost the will. And this is what this is about now. That if there was any rigging on the Brexit vote, it would have been the statist rigging to make sure that the people had no voice. And that was 71% turnout, and it was a clear majority of turning down the European community. This is genuine, and it is very similar to changes of, let's call them, great reformations, going, as I said, all the way back to ancient Egypt. The governing classes have the power. The public looks at all the perks and pleasures that they have. I'm not worried about global warfare. This is a very exciting reformation, and the public is gaining more and more control as each month goes by, and the Brexit is well publicized, and there are many public around the world who are looking at their individual governments and saying, enough. The history that I've cited you, I'll say that there's only one history, and particularly of these movements, and this is very similar to those going back over 4,500 years.
Bob Hoy, please tell us more about institutional advisors.
Oh, yeah, we do research, cover the credit markets, interest rates, metal prices, and equity markets. And we've been doing it for a long time. We have a good record, and our work has been reliable, particularly the last couple of years have been fantastic, either up or down. And you can get in touch with us at institutionaladvisors.com.
And as we wrap up here, I did forget to ask, remiss to do so, about the yellow metal and the precious metals. Have they run too far too fast? Will we see perhaps more enthusiasm on the upside, given that the Fed and now might be reversing course? There might even be a rate cut in the future. We don't see any more rate hikes this year, and perhaps none next year.
For gold in U.S. dollar terms, that's a speculation on changes in currencies. We think that the U.S. dollar is going to go up. There are times when the U.S. dollar can rally with that, but mainly what we look at is the real price of gold and whether the mining companies can make any money in mining it, and that has not much to do with the dollar price of gold. It has to do with the cost of mining it. And so far, and using gold, crude oil as the example, the price of crude has crashed relative to the price of gold, and that improves their profit margin. So speculators can look at the price of gold in U.S. dollars. Investors will look at gold shares.
Very good. We appreciate your thoughts.
Very good then, Chris. Anytime.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, last month, Chris Powell, Secretary Treasurer of GATA, the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, gave a must-hear presentation to professionals in Europe, and he joins us today with a synopsis of his comments. Welcome back, Chris Powell.
Hey, Chris. Very good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Before we jump into the lecture, the Bundesbank actually did finally receive some gold, some substantial gold repatriation. And maybe you could give us an idea what you think is going on there. Do you think the people have spoken, like in Switzerland and Amsterdam and Venezuela and other countries?
You have to suspect that world central banks are realizing that if they don't have their gold in their hands, if they've entrusted it to another central bank, bullion bank, then they probably don't really own it for practical purposes. The Bundesbank has been trying to repatriate some of its gold, or purporting to be repatriating some of its gold for the last year and a half or so, largely under pressure of a popular movement in Germany, led by people from the German Precious Metals Society. I don't think the Bundesbank has really wanted its gold back, but I think it has been trying to assuage public opinion. The strange thing about the repatriation has been that it's been so slow. I guess in the first year they managed to get all of 5 tons back. Now they announced they got 120 tons back in 2014. Of course, all of the, whatever it is, I guess, 3,000 tons or whatever it is they want to repatriate, it could be repatriated in a few weeks if anybody really wanted to, you know, put their shoulder to the wheel there. Venezuela got its gold back from the Bank of England in a few months. Obviously, the Bundesbank does not want to do this too fast. Certain observers, I think one for Deutsche Bank, said there were political difficulties for the Bundesbank in recovering its gold from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. But all these central bank gold transactions, Chris, are as obscured as they can be, because central banks do not want the world and the markets to know the true disposition of their gold reserves. The secret staff report of the International Monetary Fund in March 1999, which GATA obtained a copy of a few years ago, showed that Western central banks were afraid to disclose the true disposition of their gold reserves and their gold swaps and leases, because if the markets found out where the gold really was and how short the central banks really were, the central bank interventions in the gold market would be impaired. You know, the true location and disposition of central bank gold reserves are really secrets far more sensitive than the location and disposition of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are not ever likely to be used, but central bank gold is used every day to rig the markets.
You know, it's an interesting mechanism that they have put in place, whether intentionally or not. I guess that's an entirely separate discussion. So manipulation, and you know, it's almost a cliche, at least in the gold crowd. There's been a lot of figures, I think, thrown around for many years, And sometimes it's hard to wrap one's mind around just what's going on. Can you give us an overview of what you see happening and maybe take it point by point, please?
For decades, Chris, Western central banks have tried to control the gold price because gold is a competitive currency with central bank currencies. It's also a determinant of interest rates and government bond prices. Central banks know they have to control gold, or gold in a free market will control them. There's a long-standing U.S. government policy to push gold out of the financial system, to de-recognize it as money, to control the price. This policy is revealed in all sorts of U.S. government documents, memorandum, cables, things like that, on U.S. government's own internet site. Very frankly, U.S. government policy to subvert gold in order to maintain the dominance of the U.S. dollar as the world currency. The problem is you can't get the mainstream financial press to report on this because it leads to more and more evidence of central bank intervention in the markets, and eventually you realize there are no markets anymore. There's just interventions. But collecting these documents is what GATA has done. They're all in our documentation file on our internet site. This scheme is becoming more difficult for central banks because while they have created a vast imaginary supply of gold, paper gold, through derivatives and short selling and mechanisms like that, eventually the real metal that is always needed to underwrite the scheme runs out. It ran out in March 1968 when the London Gold Pool collapsed. The London Gold Pool was a public scheme of dishoarding of Western Central Bank gold reserves to hold the dollar gold price at $35 an ounce. It expired in March 1968 because the gold offtake through the London market was just too much. The Western Central Banks were losing their gold too fast. They withdrew from the London Gold Pool in March 68, and they began to gin up new methods to control the gold price with, and they settled on derivatives and gold swaps, gold leases. But this required required them to obscure what they were doing in the market. The gold pool was done in the open. The gold reserve figures back then were accurate and public. But now central banks create paper gold or underwrite paper gold. They sell gold futures and options and derivatives. This is all documented in the annual reports of the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. That's the central bank of the central bank. It's occasionally documented in central bank announcements themselves. For example, recently the director of market operations of the Banque de France, the French central bank, has been giving speeches to the London Bullion Market Association, saying that Western central banks are managing their gold reserves more aggressively. In September 2013, he told the LBMA that the Banque de France is trading gold for its own account and for the account of other central banks nearly on a daily basis. The fellow who founded the Gold Broker internet site, which sells gold, took me up on a challenge the other day. He wrote to the director of market operations of the Banque de France, Alexandre Gauthier, to ask him about these speeches he'd been given about central bank intervention in the gold market. And Gauthier replied to him cordially that, oh, we never give information about our market activities. All anybody who's interested in the gold market has to do to confirm that central banks are secretly intervening in the gold market every day is to ask them. You have to ask them some specific questions. You can't ask them just, are you rigging the gold market? You have to ask them specific questions like, may we see the record of your gold trading account? May we see the record of your accounts at the Bank for National Settlements? Simply, are you in the gold market or not? If you're in the gold market, is it just for fun, or are there policy purposes here? If you put specific questions to them and they acknowledge your questions, they'll just tell you, as Gauthier told Fabrice Ristori at Goldbroker the other day, is, oh, we don't answer questions like this because they don't want to give the game away. They can't expose their market interventions because if they do, the interventions will fail. Central bank policy requires deception and secrecy, and really the expropriation of investors, and that's why they won't answer questions. And actually, this is so offensive to me because it's essentially a totalitarian system. We're supposed to have democratic governments in the United States and other Western countries, accountable government, limited government, but instead we have created these institutions, unelected institutions, that create infinite money and deploy it in secret in the markets to rig the markets, and we can't find out anything about it, at least not with the cooperation of the government. You have to really dig into the archives, dig out secret governments, secret documents, and other information the governments are trying to conceal, and only then do you find out that our whole market economy is an illusion.
This is ubiquitous, this concept of our officials having their fingers in every market. There's no real price discovery. You know, it looks great on paper. You can tinker around with things and we're going to economically, but you know, that comes at a price. It seems as though if we don't have real markets, there's an end game here that doesn't bode well for the United States and frankly around the world. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, well, free markets have been one of the engines of civilization and human progress, Chris. Gold price suppression schemes, immediate victims are developing nations that can advance only by exploiting their natural resources. Every new country starts that way. The United States started that way, selling lumber and furs and fish and agricultural products. Every developing country has to start by developing its natural resources. It does not have a sophisticated banking system or technological sector. Those countries are the immediate victims of the gold price suppression scheme, the commodity price suppression scheme. But here in the United States, the center of the empire, really the originator of the gold price suppression scheme, we are victims of it too, because we lose our democracy and we lose our markets. Even certain central bankers are describing central bank market rigging policy as what they call financial repression. We have lost our markets, and since we can't see what our central banks are doing, we are losing our democracy. Since central banks are empowered to create infinite money, they are now controlling in secret the valuation of all capital, labor, goods, and services in the world. That's a totalitarian system. These values ought to be determined in the open in a democratic way, preferably through free markets. But we're letting the financial unelected elite control these values, and it's a totalitarian system. Now, you mentioned conspiracy theory. In the first place, we deal with conspiracy fact. We collect documents, records, admissions from central bankers. Much of this material still on central bank and government archives that show that what we're talking about is not mere conspiracy theory. It's conspiracy fact. Secondly, the word conspiracy is completely proper here. For example, the European Central Bank, by its own admission, by the records it has posted on its own internet site, admits that its board has met at least four times in the last 15 years or so to consider the European Central Bank's policy in the gold market. That's what the Central Bank Gold Agreements and their various incarnations have been about. Every time the European Central Bank has announced a renewal of their central bank gold agreement, it has been after secret meetings of the heads of the European central banks consulting in secret to settle upon a course of action and implement that policy. That is, by definition, conspiracy. When the European central bank gathers its board members to meet in secret, they don't invite you and they don't invite me. There's no public observance of that meeting at all. It's not announced in advance, and Nobody's invited to the meeting. That is conspiracy. When, for example, the G10 Gold and Foreign Exchange Committee meets and gathers Treasury and central bank officials from the developed world to discuss their policies in the gold market, it doesn't announce where it's meeting. It doesn't announce when. That's conspiracy, secret gathering of government officials to decide upon and implement a course of action. So I don't understand all this sneering about conspiracy theory. Government, to a great extent, is by definition conspiracy whenever it operates in secret. Nevertheless, the documents we've collected show that we're not talking about conspiracy theory. We're talking about conspiracy fact.
This is obviously not just something that's been occurring in the last 15 years since GATA has been monitoring it, at least officially. You know, I mean, we can go back to at least 100, 120 years. You might recall Samuel Clemens. I know you're a fan of his work. History never repeats itself. It rhymes. You might recall the operations of Gould and Fisk, and of course, then the President Ulysses S. Grant reportedly manipulated the gold markets, and it led to a terrible devastation for thousands of investors and speculators. It's a theme that has been persistent for quite some time. And my guess is you'd say it's far more pervasive and prevalent today than it was even back then.
We have much more sophisticated mechanisms of market rigging today. But, you know, it goes back in the United States even a little earlier than that, Chris. If you read Gene Strauss's biography of J.P. Morgan, the original J.P. Morgan, the banker, not the bank that took its name from him, Strauss recalls that back in, I believe it was 1862, the first big score that J.P. Morgan made in the markets in the United States was a gold corner on Wall Street during the Civil War. So, you know, cornering markets, rigging markets is really, you know, basic history in a market economy. We have to guard against it. You know, probably market rigging was the first thing that developed when free markets developed. But, you know, we have antitrust law, we have competition laws in order to try to maintain free markets. The problem is, in many circumstances, they're not enforced because the financial elites don't want them enforced, and they bring their political influence to bear on the government not to enforce it. And the other problem about not enforcing antitrust law is that the government itself is exempt from antitrust law. In the United States, the Gold Reserve Act specifically authorizes the U.S. Treasury Department through the Exchange Stabilization Fund to intervene secretly, not only in the gold market, but as the act was amended in the 1970s, the Exchange Stabilization Fund is now authorized to intervene secretly in any financial instrument market in the country or abroad. You can look this up on the Treasury Department's own internet site. Go to the Treasury Department's internet site and search for Exchange Stabilization Funds. Very candid page on the Treasury Department's internet site. The Exchange Stabilization Fund is explicitly authorized to rig any market in secret. And the United States is not unique in this respect. In the United Kingdom, they have something called the Exchange Equalization Account. I don't think in the UK the Exchange Equalization Account is formally authorized to do quite as much rigging as the Exchange Stabilization Fund is authorized to do in the United States. But, you know, they've got one, too. From the comments that the Bank of France Market Operations Director gave to Fabrice Ristori a few days ago, where he said, we never explain what we're doing in the markets. I imagine that France has a similar authorization for its central bank to intervene in markets secretly and to rig prices. They're doing it anyway, so I assume they must have the legal authority for it. So, you know, we only imagine that we have free markets here in the West. If you have a sophisticated central banking system, odds are you don't have any free markets anymore.
But, you know, manipulation has a tendency for blowback and ultimately for the pendulum to swing back in a fearsome manner.
Market intervention, suppression of markets, very often does result in shortages and rationing. That's really what led to the end of the London Gold Pool in March 1968. There's a funny story on the Reuters news service this week about the tampon shortage in Argentina, because Argentina has imposed a lot of foreign trade controls in order to protect its very meager foreign exchange funds left, and now there's a huge shortage of various things in Argentina, including the tampons, so that, you know, market interventions do tend to result in shortages and rationing. But, you know, they don't blow up by themselves, and when they blow up, they don't necessarily restore free markets. I am afraid that when the rig is exposed and it ends in regard to gold and other things central banks are tampering in right now, we may not end up with free markets. We may end up with more what the central bankers call financial repression. When they can't rig the markets surreptitiously anymore, they may outlaw the markets. They may impose rationing. They may impose capital controls. They may you know, take control of financial accounts. You know, the blowing up of the rig does not necessarily mean freedom. It very likely means much more repression. At least the government will come out in the open and start repressing people and repressing markets and interfering with supplies of product. But at least then, if they do that, we'll know what's happening. And I suppose that would be preferable for me to the system we have now, where many people are deceived. But yes, you know, market rigging tends to blow up, but the result is not necessarily liberation. There could be more repression.
You point out that the French Central Bank, or at least some of the officials there, intercede in the gold market on virtually a daily basis. If that's going on, just imagine what's happening with the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve. Give us an idea on just how pervasive this is and what it might mean.
I'm sure that all the major central banks in the world, even the ones in Asia who are, you know, not necessarily great allies of the Western central banks, are certainly aware of and to some extent involved in the gold price suppression scheme. We know that the Russians have been aware of it at least since 2004. That's when the deputy director of the Bank of Russia, the Russian Central Bank, Oleg Mzeyskov, gave a speech to an LBMA meeting in Moscow, in which the only words of English he spoke were "Gold Antitrust Action Committee." Now, we had no contact, to our knowledge, with anyone in Russia as of that point, so the Russians were following our work as early as 2004. We know that commentaries about gold price suppression by Western central banks often appear in the government-controlled press in China. So we know that, you know, China knows all about it. I surmised just after the great gold price smash in April 2013, China must have been complicit in that. Everybody had been saying prior to April 2013 that there was a Chinese put in the gold market. You could, you know, safely buy gold because China was, you know, going to be supporting the price. Well, you know, after the big smash on, I think it was April 12th and 15th, 2013, where the gold prices knocked down, I think, a few $100 in a very short time through enormous paper gold selling. Well, what happened to the Chinese put there? It obviously disappeared if there was one. The Chinese foreign exchange reserve, estimated at the equivalent of $4 trillion, long has been so large that China has been able to control any market it wanted to control by intervening, buying, or selling. So I deduced after that smash in April 2013 that China must have been at least complicit in the gold price smash back then, very possibly because they wanted to obtain more gold cheaply prior to a resetting of general world currency values. About the same time, a couple of U.S. economists who are also fund managers, Paul Brodsky and Lee Quaintance, wrote a paper. In fact, they may have written this paper even before the Chinese, before the April 2013 gold smash. Brodsky and Quaintance wrote a paper speculating that the real central bank game here was to redistribute world gold supplies more fairly among the major countries, redistributed it from the creditor nations, from the debtor nations to the creditor nations, so that the creditor nations like China would be able to hedge their U.S. dollar exposure with hard assets. Jim Rickards, who is a fund manager, a former lawyer for long-term capital management, former holder of U.S. Defense Department security clearance, and a frequent commenter in the news media, has been saying for some time now that based on his contacts and intelligence agencies and International Monetary Fund and central banks, that the game is indeed what Brodsky and Quaintance hypothesized a few years ago, to hold the gold price down long enough to allow the creditor nations, particularly China, to obtain gold cheaply to hedge their dollar exposure with, and that when China has enough gold that it thinks can hedge its dollar exposure, they will let the gold price go. They'll stop ringing the gold market, if only because the gold will be exhausted, the currencies will be devalued, and gold will make its reappearance as the financial asset par excellence, and the price of gold will be reset by agreement among central banks to a much higher level. Now, the problem I have with Rickards is that he doesn't really give attribution for all these things. All the sources he's talking about are not named. On the other hand, the guy is obviously brilliant. He has connections. He was a participant in a Defense Department war game, economic war game, I think 6 or so years ago. He's had U.S. Defense Department securities, security clearance. He's been to a lot of places, and I know he's talked to a lot of people. I know him a little bit, and I follow his work and his assertions very closely. And while I'm a journalist and I have to suspect anybody who makes very serious assertions without giving sources by name, I think what Rickards is saying is it matches my own observations. It matches the observations of Brodsky and Quaintance, and I think it's more than plausible. I think what he's saying is probable, which means that all the major central banks are in on the gold price suppression scheme, and that they are, as Brodsky and Quaintance speculated a few years ago, working to redistribute the world's gold supplies so that the dollar creditor nations are hedged when the dollar is devalued.
It's certainly an intriguing scenario you've outlined. For instance, isn't it interesting, this skyrocket in the price of the greenback, all while the yellow metal has obviously retraced substantially from its 2011 peak. That would present a unique opportunity for a central bank which does not disclose, at least not on a regular basis, its gold reserves to accumulate en masse. Bill Murphy has pointed out here on the show that you made a special trip to China and obviously presented your outlook there. I mean, you must have a clear idea, at least better than most of us.
I've spoken a few times at conferences in Hong Kong, and I've been told that certain influential people attended. If they did, I don't know who they were. I've had no direct contact with anyone, to my knowledge, at the People's Bank of China. I have talked to certain other central banks in Asia, and even as I have to admit that most of the central banks I've asked to talk to don't even acknowledge my mail, even when I send it to International Express. But I do know, interests from the government-controlled news organizations in China, whose reports were cabled back to the State Department in Washington from the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. I know from those cables, which were disclosed a couple of years ago by the WikiLeaks organization, that the government of China knows all about the Western gold price suppression scheme. It is a frequent topic in the Chinese financial press, and I know also that the U.S. government knows that China knows, because those Chinese government press reports were cabled back from the U.S. Embassy to the State Department of Washington. So China knows, and the U.S. government knows that China knows. And all these documents and others are posted on Gatta's Internet site and in the documentation section. And I really urge anybody who doubts the general outline of what Gatta says to look at those documents and let us know if any of them are forgeries or if any of them are being misconstrued. And I really find no one in the mainstream financial press and no one in the financial industry is interested at all in discussing those documents.
The People's Bank of China's U.S. dollar reserves are clearly a monumental vulnerability that we have here. Do you see them pulling the nuclear trigger? Would they play that card in the future, and what might that mean for the market?
Well, you know, the old, you know, saying, if, you know, you owe the bank $1,000, you got a problem. If you owe them $1 billion, they got a problem. I am not one of those people who thinks that the People's Bank of China is so smart. I think to amass a foreign exchange surplus almost entirely in U.S. dollars, I think they are just as much at the mercy of the United States as the United States is at the mercy of China. You know, Rickards has said, you know, both countries are kind of in a delicate dance here. The United States doesn't want China to dump the dollars and the treasuries, and you know, China doesn't want them to go down in value until China's been able to hedge them. So, Rickards has argued, and I've argued, others have argued that the game here is really a cooperation between the United States and China to allow China to gradually obtain enough gold and hard assets to hedge its U.S. dollar exposure against the day when the dollar has to be devalued. When that will come, I don't know. I'm sure I'll be as surprised as anybody else. But I don't think that the Chinese were so smart to you know, tie so much of their fortune into the U.S. dollar. I think they woke up to this problem rather late.
I wonder if you could give folks an idea of what it is that you see that makes this time in market history, if you will, different from, let's say, 1980 to the year 2000. You know, after a big peak in the precious metals, a lot of people have lost some of their enthusiasm. But my guess is that fundamentally, at least some gray swans for every investor to take note of.
My value, if I have any in this field, is simply as the archivist of the records, Chris, maybe my ability as a journalist to pick up more quickly, maybe than some others do, on contradictions and consistencies. As a financial analyst, I think I have very, very little to offer the world. But you know, there are certain indications that are implied by the documents that Gatta has collected, and probably the foremost among them is that there is a huge naked short position in investment-grade gold in the world, that the paper gold of the world outweighs the real metal in the investment world by, you know, a huge factor. It's been estimated to 50 to 1 or even 100 to 1. Most of the investment-grade gold that the investment world thinks it owns almost certainly does not exist. Now, if central banks are beginning to realize that their gold outside their vaults has probably been, you know, hypothecated and rehypothecated and compromised, and they want to repatriate it. If they realize that the dollar and the currencies are going to have to be devalued, and indeed are already being devalued, then there is going to be a move toward obtaining physical gold. And if there is a move toward physical in circumstances where there is a huge imbalance between the physical and the paper, that, of course, implies a much higher price for the physical. I think that will happen someday. It will happen, I don't know, maybe it'll happen when central banks lose control, or more likely when they realize they're about to lose control and they try to get in front of the gold issue by revaluing gold themselves. I think that's really much most likely to happen, that someday we will be just about to go to bed here in the West, and we'll turn on the 11 o'clock news on a Sunday night, and we'll find out that the major central bankers have been meeting in Switzerland or somewhere, and they're announcing a new currency system or a new currency valuation that involves gold at a much higher price. So these things happen every 30 or 40 years or so. Sometimes they involve gold and sometimes they don't. But I think central banks, rather than lose control of their rigging completely, will probably realize that the shorting of gold can no longer be sustained, that there's too much demand for real metal, and that gold has to be revalued at a much higher price. And central banks, I think, will want to be seen to be the ones doing it, so people think that the central banks are still in control, that the markets has not taken control. And I think that's what we will see someday. I don't know if I will live long enough to see that day. I hope I do, because that day will be, I think, a mark of a little bit of the failure of the totalitarian system. Unfortunately, I think when they revalue gold upward, it will simply be the first day of the next 50 years of gold price suppression at a higher, more sustainable level.
Interesting. And one really wonders how long that will last, because just as we saw the ruble revalue in 7 weeks' time by 100% against gold, gold skyrocketing, folks losing half of their purchasing power, there's precedent. I mean, this could happen, I think, much more abruptly than maybe a lot of top forecasters and analysts are, you know, are expecting.
Oh, yeah, there's major things like this have to be done overnight. You can't, the fiat system cannot survive a sustained withdrawal. It'll build into an avalanche. If gold is going to be revalued substantially, it will happen overnight. Look what happened with the Swiss National Bank's repudiation of its euro peg. I mean, the exchange value of the Swiss franc for a little while went up 40%. There have been whole brokerage houses that have been ruined, bankrupted by this move. This is disgraceful. This is expropriation. This is treachery. It's betrayal. The Swiss National Bank, really almost until hours before it repudiated the euro peg, it was swearing that it would keep it forever.
Well, but weren't they really front-running, though, the upcoming ECB meeting, the European ministers?
Well, they very well may have been, and I'm sure they feel they were forced into it. Nevertheless, they were telling you, they were telling me, they were telling, you know, your broker and everybody else that, oh, no, this policy is irrevocable. We're going to keep it forever. And the people made investment decisions based on that solemn pledge. And, it's another reason against central banking, at least as it is conducted in the West today, which is completely in secret by people who are not elected.
No, exactly. I mean, rehypothecation, I think, is going to be a term with many different monikers in the years to come. We've seen it pop up all over the world, beginning, I think, with Cyprus, running through Europe, and now much of the legislation from Canada, the U.S., and all around the globe has this nefarious verbiage written into it. Borrowers and lenders, everybody has the potential to wake up, as you say, and find out the terms have been changed.
Listen, there is not one nominally democratic country and not one parliament, Congress in a nominally democratic country that has any idea of the full range of interventions being undertaken right now by their own central banks. And you can't maintain a democracy when you don't know what such a powerful agency is doing. And you don't have a democracy when this secretive unelected agency can change economic values on you by 40% or 100% overnight. That's not a democratic system.
Chris Powell, as we wrap up, I wonder if you might share any parting comments that you have with listeners today. You have, you know, a wealth of knowledge, and I'm sure there might just be one or two other topics that you'd like to leave with the listeners.
I'd like to tell them to send money. We're broke. The monetary metals industry and its investors have been devastated over the last 3 years, and they were the primary donors to GATA. We are a nonprofit civil rights and educational organization. We have tax exempt status in the United States under Section 501c3 of the U.S. Internal Revenue Code. Donations to GATA in the United States are federally tax deductible for people, and we really could use a little help because our operations, other than running our mouths on the telephone, are about to come to a halt because our treasury is close to being below ordinary operating expenses on a month-to-month basis. If people are if they've got anything, if your listeners have got anything left, and I would understand completely if they did not, because we don't, and they feel like helping, I would thank them for going to our internet site, gata.org, and looking for the How to Help button on the left-hand side of the page, and they could make donations by credit card over the internet or check or Bitcoin, or if they want, they could even mail cash to my house, and I promise I'll put it in our account in the bank.
Very good. Well, you know, support the good guys, and you all have certainly spent at least the last 15 years or so to try to disseminate the truth and the information that we all need. So please help support GATA.org, Bill Murphy and Chris Powell, and everything they do. We want to thank you for taking time today and look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio, sir.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris.
This is Robert Ian with ClunkerChange.com. Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ClunkerChange.com. Since the attention-getting Brexit vote 1 week ago, just about everyone you can imagine has weighed in on the subject. It's now the official flavor of the day. The metaphor which this historic vote supposedly represents is being spun by the best of them, with predictions and prognostications about what is going to happen next as a result of this defiant vote. Some are suggesting Brexit is a non-starter because of Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which can only be enacted by Parliament. Remember, there is a 2-year window to either negotiate or undo this vote. If you look around the media, you'll see lots of discussion indicating there is no majority in Parliament for Brexit. Nor was the referendum legally binding, because it is said only Parliament can trigger Article 50. This is by no means over. Unfortunately, this is going to go legal. The lawyers are already involved. John Kerry is already on record as saying the Brexit vote could be walked back. For those that are alarmed and upset, don't be. This is not new behavior. The only exception is the size and visibility of the vote expressed by the people that will be attempted over the next 2 years to be changed is extremely large in scope. Often these kinds of votes that citizens make that clash with anticipated plans happen at the local level. I remember as a teenager observing small-town politics in action. A local school board would recommend building a new school or a new addition to an existing school instead of a more cost-effective and less fancy solution, and the local citizens would vote the measure down. But that wouldn't be the end of it. The measure would get reintroduced often several times, and the referendum questions would get trickier and trickier to understand. To boot, elections would be held at odd times with expected low voter turnout. This process would go on until the voters got worn out and the measure passed. Property taxes would go up, and the new school would be built. Rinse and repeat on the next project. The Brexit exercise is going to be very similar on how local constituents and votes get walked back, and have been walked back in municipalities everywhere for decades. Some, like Alan Greenspan, are asserting that other countries like Scotland will want to leave the EU as well. In fact, many EU countries are now talking about wanting to leave. Any country that pushes itself back from its place at the EU table will do so only to have a seat at the new negotiating table, which is being set as we speak. Brexit is about brinksmanship and negotiating prowess and leverage. It's about aligning and redirecting what will ultimately be renegotiated rules of engagement on debt, regulations, sovereignty, and other issues for all parties involved. A long battle of isometrics will be unleashed against the people. Success requires engagement and an unwavering tenacity against a rinse-and-repeat cycle that will be designed to wear even the strongest down. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. and founding director. Their Sao George project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.